Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, June 19th, 2015. The Confederate flag continues to flutter over the state capitol in South Carolina. Oh, the South is just doing it again.
Well, a train to grind a switch is running right on time, and the Tucker boys are cooking down in Carolina. People down in Florida can't be still when old Leonard Skinner's picking down in Jacksonville. People down in Georgia come from near and far to hear Richard Best picking on that red guitar. So gather round, now gather round, chill and be down. Well, just get down, chill and get loud.
Well, now, I dig Southern rock, and I've met Charlie Daniels. He and I don't share much in the way of political views, but he does put on a rockin' good show. And the South is doing it again, because as the fallout continues from Wednesday night's shootout at the Bible class in Charleston, there are many people from all over the country who are saying, get rid of the hateful, racist legacy image of the Confederate flag. Now, let me acknowledge that I'm comfortably ensconced here in liberal San Francisco. And I know that there's a lot of loyalty to the Confederate flag. And there are people who regard it as their First Amendment right to display it and to embrace it. The distinction I draw is when the government displays an icon of this nature. And so, if old boys, rednecks, anybody else wants to have a Confederate flag, want to display it on the front license plate of your car, I think you're free to do so. But the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that the state of Texas cannot be compelled to produce a license plate with a Confederate flag. And the decision made the distinction between private, personal, First Amendment, amendment-protected speech and the speech of a government entity. And I'd love to see Governor Nikki Haley take the lead here and say, okay, it is time, it is past time for us to distance ourselves from this emblem of hate. And I hope that this could be the takeaway from these tragic events this week in Charleston. I don't know that that will happen. I'm pretty convinced that we're not going to see any new restrictions on guns, because the nuts from the gun-loving NRA are out there blaming victims like Pastor Pinckney, because as a state senator, he voted for gun registration, restriction on open carry, and other bills that came before the legislature. They're claiming that it's his fault that there weren't armed members of the congregation who could have taken out the suspect during that shooting spree. And so I find the coverage and the reaction to this almost as uncomfortable as the grisly event itself. I was watching Rachel Maddow's coverage on MSNBC last night, and it's like she's morphed into the liberal Nancy Grace. And there she was, refusing to identify the suspect by his name, Dylan Storm Roof. And they pixelated all the pictures. And this was so bizarre, because you understand what a perp walk is, right? That's the brief footage that they get of cops escorting a suspect, you know, from a doorway to a van, from a van into a jail. In this case, they put him on a plane. And so Maddow's team was rolling the B-roll constantly while she was talking about this and talking to people about it. And what's the point of perp walk B-roll if you fuzz out the image of the perp? And I do understand the mentality. They're saying, well, you know, you don't want to give this guy publicity. You want to, don't want to give him the ego stroke that he appears to have sought through this ugly killing. But I don't buy that. I mean, we all know who the guy is in Colorado who shot up the Batman movie. Has he been glorified, turned into a martyr, turned into some sort of a hero because we know his name is James Holmes? I don't think so. And President Obama, you know, this is a tough role for the president, any president, to take on a set of issues like this in the aftermath of a mass killing. But Obama's comments were remarkably self-referential. It was about him and about how he is tired and frustrated of having to console a nation after another mass killing. And I understand what he was trying to say, but I just feel it came off as kind of self-serving and self-centered at a time when our focus should be on the people who died and looking at ways to heal and prevent this from happening again. Well, we're in day two of the coverage of Pope Francis' historic encyclical, where he calls for the world to pay attention to climate change. And he framed it, I think, in an excellent way. Scientists say that he didn't make any blunders in his description of the problem. And as I pointed out yesterday, I am so pleased to see the Catholic Church trying to provide moral leadership and teaching on issues other than human sexuality. And so for the Pope to take on the issue of climate change and the economics that surround it, and that also drive his concern for the impact on the poor on the planet, I think is quite appropriate. And it resonates. So one of the key takeaways from the encyclical is that climate change and inequality of wealth and income are inextricably linked. He argues that the global economy must protect the earth, not simply exploit it. Quote, "The economy accepts every advance in technology with a view to profit without concern for its potentially negative impact on human beings." He says that everyone must divest from fossil fuels and invest in the future. "We know that technology based on the use of highly polluting fossil fuels needs to be progressively replaced without delay." And he says that powerful nations have to pay our fair share. Quote, "A true ecological debt exists, particularly between the global North and South. In different ways, developing countries, where the most important reserves of the biosphere are found, continue to fuel the development of richer countries at the cost of their own present and future." And the Pope concluded that there's no easy way out of this, that we've got to focus on it, bear down, and take action. And one of the comments in the Pope's encyclical, which is either confounding or pissing off some of the institutional environmentalists, is that he took a swipe at cap and trade. And I've never been comfortable with this economic model that attempts to use market forces to incentivize polluters to pollute less. And we have a cap and trade system here in California, which is, you know, an interesting model and it's a start. But the Pope is correct when he says the strategy of buying and selling carbon credits can lead to a new form of speculation, which would not help reduce the emission of polluting gases worldwide. This system seems to provide a quick and easy solution under the guise of a certain commitment to the environment, but in no way does it allow for the radical change which present circumstances require. Rather, it may simply become a ploy which permits maintaining the excessive consumption of some countries and sectors. And he's correct, because the big polluters make a lot of money from the energy or other products they generate with the pollution byproduct. And they're basically buying a license to continue to pollute. And sure, you know, it's supposed to be a penalty that causes them to try to clean up their act over time. And the payment of those monies to government, which should be distributed to the poorest people who will be impacted by higher energy costs. Instead, not so much. I've heard of concepts called cap and dividend, where you take the money from the polluters and you give it to people who are highly impacted by the increase in energy costs. That makes more sense than trading credits among polluting industries or groups. Well, the deadline is looming for Greece to confront its lenders. And there is a kind of modest run on the banks. They're not saying that there's a panic so far. But the European Central Bank today increased its emergency funding to the banks in Greece in order to maintain some liquidity there. It's the second time this week that they have pumped money into the Greek banking system. So the talks ended last night without a breakthrough. An emergency summit meeting of 19 Eurozone leaders is scheduled for Monday. And, of course, June 30th is the actual default date. And we'll be watching this very carefully to see how the Cyprus government is able to navigate the minefield of the debt and the burden of austerity, which really is stifling the Greek economy and causing real hardship for average citizens. Cyprus himself was at a conference in St. Petersburg, Russia today, and there is speculation, without anything further to prove it, that he is angling for some sort of a bailout from Vladimir Putin. We'll see if that happens. We've reached a very ugly statistical landmark. The highest number ever reported of refugees on our planet. Just shy of 60 million, the official count, estimated at 59.5 million, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Pointing to crises in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Burundi, and elsewhere, the High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, said he doesn't expect any improvement this year. The Iraq-Syria crisis, he says, gained the dimensions of a mega one, and at the same time, the old crises have no solution. Now, there are 38 million people who are displaced within their own countries. And last year, there were 51.2 million people displaced worldwide, so there's an increase of about 8 million in the past 12 months alone. Whoops. We missed. Yes, last weekend there were two airstrikes, one by drones, one by fighter jets. The drone strike, we're told, took out a major terrorist leader. And that was reported to be confirmed on the ground. And that was Nasser al-Uhayshi, the leader of al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, killed by a drone strike in Yemen. But on Monday morning this past week, we also claimed that we took out Mokhtar Belmokhtar. He's one of the jihadist leaders in Libya. He is blamed for the 2013 events at an Algerian gas plant that left 38 foreign hostages dead. And the U.S. struck a facility where they confirmed that he was the actual target. Over in Yemen, in the case of Uhayshi, they said, well, no, that was a signature strike. We just hit a group of people, and he happened to be one of them. But no such luck in Libya, where Belmokhtar's allies have said the jihadist commander Khalid Abu Abbas is still alive and kicking and wandering the land of God. And in French intelligence circles, Belmokhtar has the nickname the Uncatchable because of the number of times that he has falsely been declared dead. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions, like Michelle Pasco in Sacramento, Janet Price, a longtime subscriber who gives $10 a month, thank you, and Kevin Glimpf, who we mentioned recently took out a new annual subscription. Hope you're enjoying your bonus gift, Kevin. I need some new subscribers, and I'd love to come in on Monday and find out that 10 new people signed up for monthly or annual subscriptions at peterbcollins.com. Just come on over, click on the link under my picture that says sign up. The next page, you choose your contribution level, sign up for a PayPal account, and it's easy. Just takes a few minutes. If you sign up for one of those annual subscriptions and you're a newbie, I will reward you with an ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest called Empire of Chaos. As you know, I'm highly skeptical of many of the pronouncements that come from the FBI that they have broken up a plot of terrorists or that they have prevented a would-be jihadist from going to the Middle East to join the Islamic State. So a couple of days ago, I told you about the bust last weekend of a 20-year-old college student from Queens named Munther Saleh. Now, we were told at the time that he was trying to learn how to build a pressure cooker bomb. He didn't have a pressure cooker, didn't have any other materials, but he was trying to learn how. And he was busted when he and a buddy got out of their car and apparently charged at a surveillance vehicle. They knew that they were being tailed. Now, we learned in the first accounts that Saleh had permitted the FBI to look at his computer. After his arrest, it was reported that he made Facebook posts, that he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, that he expressed a desire to hurt cops in this country. Now the case is widening. There are three other suspects who have been picked up. A 21-year-old New Jersey man charged on Thursday, planning to travel overseas to support the Islamic State. And by the way, what law does that violate? I'm really not clear on why it is a crime. If I want to go join the French Foreign Legion or the Islamic State or you name it, aren't I free to do that? I don't know. So the new suspect is Samuel Topaz of Fort Lee, New Jersey. He's now accused of providing material support and resources to the Islamic State. And as you know, material support is the flimsiest of charges brought by our government in these terrorism cases. So the day before, they arrested another 21-year-old, Farid Moumini. And during that arrest, he was also accused of trying to stab the FBI agent who was executing a search warrant at his Staten Island home. Apparently, he tried several times to jab a kitchen knife into the FBI agent, but we're told that his bulletproof vest prevented that. So now we get into the coverage where we learn about the informant. Earlier this year, a friend of Mr. Topaz began talking to the authorities. He told them several people, including a man who fits Saleh's description, were trying to recruit Topaz for overseas travel by preying on his insecurities. This according to a criminal complaint prepared by an FBI special agent. So now we know that there was an informant in the midst of this group. We haven't yet learned that it was a paid informant, or that, as in other cases, the informant may have supplied ideas about a pressure cooker bomb or killing cops or any of that. So now we get the text leaked by the government of text messages traded between Topaz and, again, we think it's Saleh, but we're not sure. Bro, I'm not sure how much longer I can take not being in the Dala, honestly. Referring to the Islamic State. They discussed traveling to Turkey and then the Islamic State, and Topaz described efforts to raise money for the trip. Now, what's interesting in this account is just a moment ago, we were told he was communicating with somebody who fits Saleh's description. Now the account flatly says that Saleh replied. Then you're going to enter the land of no music and no preverts taking girls out to violate them, no intoxication, no filth, period. Allahu Akbar. The following week, after Saleh's arrest, Topaz allegedly grew nervous and told another person, "We gotta leave ASAP." Now, all of this is just freestanding leaks from the government. There's no context for it. As I mentioned, at one point they're not sure it's Saleh, and two sentences later, they just flatly say it's him. And so, once again, we have a case where it appears that individuals are being arrested because of their First Amendment expressions, supportive of the Islamic State, and very little else. And the story is shifting because I told you about the pressure cooker bomb plot, right? And the only allegation is that Saleh was studying about how to make one. There's no indication he bought a pressure cooker or put nails in it or any of that stuff. But now the charging documents describe him as having the most advanced plan for carrying out an attack. He was studying electric circuitry, the authorities said, and shopping for materials to build an explosive device. Now, once again, this imputes a motive. He may have been online looking at pressure cookers because he likes to cook Swiss steak, or I don't know what else you cook in a pressure cooker. Artichokes, that's what I've used them for. But these stories get picked up and treated as fact and are used to create the hysteria that, oh, the Islamic State is everywhere among us and we have to be fearful and give up our rights. I'm not buying it. Well, Brian Williams went on the Today Show this morning. I wasn't watching, but the TV critic at the New York Times, Alessandra Stanley, was. She writes that Brian Williams couldn't say the L word. On the Today Show Friday morning, the former NBC anchor Brian Williams used every verbal variation imaginable to express error and regret. Everyone, that is, except the two words his colleague-turned-inquisitor Matt Lauer kept pressing him to say, quote, "I lied." She describes the cool, calm, and suave Mr. Williams as breaking out into a Dick Nixon flop sweat. And she writes, "It was a tortured mea culpa that didn't close the chapter. Mostly it raised more questions and gave hardened media scolds another chance to castigate a man who has been punished plenty." Williams used the word torture to describe the last several months. He was suspended, as you know. And in resisting the word lie, he said he didn't intentionally mislead people. He said that when he began telling people that he was in a helicopter that had been hit and forced down by enemy fire in Iraq, he was misleading himself. "It got mixed up," he said. "It got turned around in my mind." And then he said, "I told the story correctly for years before I told it incorrectly." Huh? And Stanley writes, "It was an oddly inarticulate explanation for an anchor known for his verbal facility and poise." And that made it all the more plausible. Nobody wants to be called a liar. Nobody wants to admit deliberately misleading people. Williams didn't go into any deep psychological reasons for his colossal unforced error, except to say that vanity played a part. He stated several times his ego got the better of him. He didn't lie, he just didn't tell the truth. Well, it's clear that NBC is deeply invested in Brian Williams, and they're moving him down to the minor leagues, busting him down to MSNBC, where he will preside over breaking coverage. As if that will help restore his credibility. I'm not sure you can. I think they're chasing some clouds here. I've known Joe Cirincione, he's got a difficult name, for over 10 years. He is the president of the Plowshares Fund, based here in San Francisco. And he's an expert on nuclear armaments who is committed to nuclear disarmament. And he writes about the recent fundraiser gala that Plowshares Fund held. And their guest speaker was former Joint Chiefs Vice Chairman, retired Marine General James Cartwright. And he stunned this group when he told them that our nuclear forces are hit by countless cyber attacks on a daily basis. And that he worries that because our nuclear weapons, at least a part of the arsenal, is on constant alert, that hackers could break in and possibly fire a missile. A key problem, he said, is that we keep hundreds of missiles on hair trigger alert. They're called Minutemen for a reason, Cartwright said. And so, this is a very serious concern. I have serious concerns about the personnel files being hacked. But you can't launch a missile, much less a nuclear missile, with a personnel file. I'm glad you raised that, Joe. Thank you. Ashton Carter, the defense secretary, was on Capitol Hill this week at the House Armed Services Committee and admitted that we're not going to meet our goal to train 24,000 new Iraqi troops by this fall. The reason is that we only have about 7,000 recruits in Iraq. And this just is another example of the incoherent mission and strategy that we're embarked on. The Congress has approved hundreds of millions of dollars to train so-called moderates in Syria that can't be found, and billions of dollars to train Iraqi soldiers who aren't stepping forward to fight for their country. You can't train them to want to fight. You can't train them to want to protect a country that doesn't really exist. You're not going to get Sunnis to volunteer for an army that they see run by the Shiites, aimed at their elimination or at least marginalization. And so it's all folly. It is sheer folly. And yet there's very little debate about it in this country. We pretend that it's all going to work out and that the brilliant American forces will prevail in the end. And it's just a big pile of horse shit. The Pentagon has released a 1,204-page volume, a manual covering the laws of war. It's been 20 years in the making. And it's available so that generals on the battlefield can dip into this 1,200-page book and say, gosh, I wonder if the cluster bombs we just dropped are okay. And this document, as I said, 20 years in preparation, barely mentions drones. In sections that do mention drones, the manual is unequivocal that drones, whatever their use, are legal. And likewise, while it's not the Pentagon that ran the Guantanamo camp, that ran the black sites, that engaged in the interrogation of would-be terrorists or terrorist suspects, the military was involved in the security of these facilities. The military had to have awareness of the torture that occurred. And so having a manual doesn't mean diddly. If people don't have ethics and training and accountability when they fail to live up to standards, whether they're in a manual or encoded in law. Well, a new study from Stanford University professor Mark Zoback looked at the earthquakes caused by fracking in Oklahoma and came up with some interesting findings. They studied the towns near Oklahoma City, Jones, Perry, and Cherokee, where heavy fracking has been going on for several years now. And the finding is that it is not so much the fracking process itself or the chemical cocktails that are pumped into the ground to loosen up the rock and free up the oil or natural gas and get it to come to the surface. The biggest cause of the earthquakes appears to be from the pumping of brackish wastewater back into the ground. They inject it under the level where they believe the gas and oil are located. And sometimes these wells that they pump it into are located near the fault line. That's not necessarily where the gas or oil well is. It's where the wells where they're pumping this wastewater are located. So the study found that the culprit in the quakes is far less likely to be the fluids used in the process itself than the salty wastewater, which is generated in far larger quantities by either conventional drilling or fracking. Now, more than two dozen earthquakes over magnitude 2.5 have hit Oklahoma in just the past week, including a 4.0 that rocked the town of Perry this Wednesday. The scientists recommend that drillers stop injecting wastewater into what's called the Arbuckle Formation and instead pump it into the other oil-rich formations where the pressure can make wells more productive. But one of the experts said even if the practice stopped tomorrow, it could take months or years for the earthquakes to subside. And Dan McNamara at the National Earthquake Information Center said that drilling-related earthquakes aren't unique to Oklahoma, but other states that have seen heavy oil and gas drilling in recent years don't have as many fault lines. And he raises questions about the sensitive seismology of the area near Cushing, Oklahoma, which is the huge intersection of oil and gas pipelines. We'll keep an eye on that. Now, I have been a blistering critic of Apple Computer for its tax-dodging techniques by, for example, booking my purchase of a song on iTunes in Belgium or Ireland, pretending that the transaction didn't take place in the United States. Now, because Apple's products in many cases are not tangible, sure, an iPhone, an iPad, that's a hard item, but many of the intangible goods of software and music content and that sort of thing, it's harder to prove where they were living when I purchased them. But now we learn that Walmart has been copying Apple. It has a vast undisclosed network of 78 subsidiaries in 15 overseas tax havens. These 78 subsidiaries in 15 offshore nations have never been reported before. And as one of the biggest corporations in the world, I have to wonder how Walmart is able to pretend that that chainsaw that you bought at their store in Bentonville, Arkansas, could somehow be booked, you know, the sale could be booked to a subsidiary in Luxembourg. Well, I don't understand how all this works. But in Luxembourg, Walmart has 22 shell companies, 20 established since 2009, and 5 this year alone. They don't have a single store in Luxembourg. But it's transferred ownership of more than $45 billion in assets to Luxembourg subsidiaries since 2011. It reported paying less than 1% in tax to Luxembourg on $1.3 billion in profits from 2010 to 2013. You know, Sam Walton set up Walmart as this all-American company that would only sell American-made products. And now his billionaire offspring sell more imported Chinese cheap goods than any other retailer in the country I can think of. And now they won't even pay American taxes on the profits they extract here. And finally today, a couple of stories about bodies that fall out of the sky. First, about asteroids. June 30th has been declared Asteroid Day, and Brian May, the astrophysicist who was also the lead guitarist in Queen, is involved with a group called Sentinel Mission, formerly known as the B612 Foundation, And in full disclosure, my friend Danica Remy is the chief operating officer of this nonprofit. And they're dedicated to learning more about the patterns of asteroids and working to prevent asteroids from hitting planet Earth by deflecting them in outer space. Now, I don't pretend to understand all of the science here. I'm only dubious that at some points they talk about using a nuclear-detonated weapon in space to deflect an asteroid. And I am not in favor of weaponizing space even for this purpose. But I'm going to put up a link to sentinelmission.org so you can learn more about this, and maybe you want to observe June 30th as Asteroid Day. After all, in 2013, a 7,000-ton rock about 60 feet wide exploded over the Russian city of Chelyabinsk, injuring 1,500 people as shards flew from shattered windows. So it can happen. And while the Earth is huge and a meteor or an asteroid could hit in an area that's not populated, this is a real-time example that it can hit an area that's populated. So check out the website of sentinelmission.org and make your choice to observe Asteroid Day on June 30th. And the other bodies that fell out of the sky were humans. Two men stowed away on a British Airways flight from Johannesburg, South Africa, to London's Heathrow. One of them has survived. He's in a hospital. And the other is believed to have fallen or somehow dropped out of the aircraft just as it was about to land at Heathrow. The plane would have been at an altitude of just about 1,400 feet. Based on where this body was found on the roof of a West London office building. Now, there's still an investigation underway. Scotland Yard says they don't have evidence to link the body on the ground to stowaways on the plane. But that is at least the circumstantial evidence available right now. And ironically, the victim fell onto the offices of a business called NotOnTheHighStreet.com. And as you know, may know the in British lingo, the high street is the main street in any village or town. And so he didn't land on the high street. He actually landed on the offices of Not on the High Street. And this points up to security issues, because on a flight that long, it's hard to imagine that they were able to stow away in the wheel wells. So it suggests they at least got into the baggage compartment, where it can be quite cold, but it's a survivable, apparently, a survivable experience. And so we will now tighten up security on airport perimeters to try to prevent this from happening again. Thanks for joining me today. This is my news and comment podcast. You're free to distribute it absolutely anywhere in the world, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.